8,000 feet. Everything was looking good then.
That's going from the braking phase into the approach phase.
That's right. That's where we transfer from the braking to the, what we call the powered descent phase, or the approach phase, as you call it. Once we got past this point, the communications cleared up immeasurably and were excellent from that point on. As we started coming in down to around 1,000 feet, the crew took over manual control of the spacecraft attitude, and shortly thereafter they went to a semi-automatic control of the descent engine. They used what we call the
P-66?
That's right, P-66, and they used what we call a rate of descent switch, and this is a very vernier throttle. The throttle essentially remains fixed, however, the crew can click a switch, and for every time they click it, they can kill their descent rate by a foot per second or add on it an additional foot per second into their descent rate.
Mm-hmm. He did use that onto descent.
Yes,
searching for a smooth spot.
He used that for about the last 500 to 600 feet of the descent, and from that time on, our prime job on the ground is monitoring his propellant remaining and keeping him advised of the status. Our low-level warning light came on. That's equivalent to about 5.5% fuel. This came on. We continued to monitor the fuel. We advised the crew when they had 60 seconds of propellant remaining. We came back and advised
them. We very clearly heard Charlie Duke transmit 60 seconds. We could hear that very clearly.
That's right, and he came back with another call about 30 seconds later, obviously, saying 30 seconds. And about 10 seconds later, the crew touched down. We saw the crew shut down the engine. We took a quick look at the attitudes, and we knew he was down and in a stable position.
What was the problem, or what was the situation with the mission clock?
This is a digital clock that counts in hundreds of hours, minutes, and seconds that they use for staying up with the ground elapsed time. In other words, it's a total time since either the beginning of the mission. It's a common reference point between the spacecraft and ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And they had to reset it a time or two to get it in line.
Well, present time, the clock is apparently not working. We're going to continue to troubleshoot it later. We don't feel this has any serious impact on the mission, however.
Well, there you have it, our listeners all over the world. There's the word from the man who guided them on all of the events leading to touchdown. And now let's make a personal observation. How do you feel yourself, Gene? How did you react? What did you really feel?
Well,
I heard you slap the console and told all the guys, let's get back to work now. Is that right?
Yeah, we have. It's pretty difficult to say. Immediately after touchdown, you've got two very critical time periods that you're actually counting down to the next liftoff. The next possible liftoff after touchdown occurs about 3 minutes after touchdown.
And all of you are busy at
that
point.
So at that time, we have to very quickly go across all of the spacecraft systems, the guidance systems, and all of the functions that we can possibly see on telemetry and make what we call a stay-no-stay decision. If it's no stay at that time, the crew will push their abort stage button and they'll be going back up from whence they came. Now, as soon as you finish that countdown, that one takes place 3 minutes after touchdown. There's another one that takes place 12 minutes after touchdown.
That was T2.
And that's what we call the T2 stay-no-stay.
Mm-hmm.
So it was only after we had gotten past the T2 stay-no-stay that I could really sit back and examine my feelings, and it felt great.
At that point, you reached over and took out a cigarette and lit it up, and I proceeded to tell our listeners that that's what was happening.
I had been trying not to smoke throughout the whole mission, and I did very well up until the time of descent. In fact, it was sometime yesterday that finally the habit came back to me.
Okay, how did you and how do you feel?
I think it's great. I feel that the people who have contributed to this immense project, the flight controllers, the people who provide them data, the people who built the spacecraft, the people of the United States ought to feel very deeply involved in this thing, and they ought to feel very proud.
And as Dr. Payne pointed out in his briefing and statement to us, this indeed is an effort for all mankind.
I certainly agree on that, and it's one that I'm glad that we can share, both through the various press media, the TV, the radio networks, the whole world. It's great to come up and say, hey, here's what we're going to do. And we're going to let you know everything we're doing, and we're going to make you feel like you're really participating in it. That is what I think is great.
Okay, thanks very much, Gene Kranz, for coming in with us on our worldwide network of listeners and transmitters, and we wish you good luck on the very, very important next phase, the extravehicular activity on the surface of the moon, and also that ascent back into orbit and return to Earth. Do you fellows in Washington, Al Johnson, you or Don Beatty, have any quick question for Gene?
No, as a matter of fact, no quick questions. If we were to get involved, we probably would talk for hours to him. We want to thank him very much for an extremely lucid and certainly a dramatic things which he had to say, because he obviously is so involved. So we want to thank both of you gentlemen very much for that excellent report. And of course, read periodically throughout this night, we'll be hearing further from you. And incidentally, speaking of persons whom we hear, whom we expect to hear from later on, we expect to have a gentleman from the Grumman Aircraft Corporation. That's the firm which built the lunar module which made the safe landing on the moon at 20 hours, 18 minutes, and 42 seconds GMT. And to repeat quickly, the extra-vehicular activity, the two astronauts leaving the module, will begin at 1 hour GMT. This program is originating in Washington. We will return to our live Voice of America coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
The Apollo astronauts now plan to leave the lunar landing craft Eagle for man's first steps on the moon in less than an hour and a half from now at 1 hour GMT. Command pilot Neil Armstrong will make the first descent down the lander's ladder to the lunar surface, followed about 20 minutes later by astronaut Edwin Aldrin. They are scheduled to spend about 2 hours exploring on the moon's surface. With the words, "The Eagle has landed," astronaut Armstrong announced to the world man's arrival on the moon at 20 hours, 1840 Greenwich Mean Time. President Nixon, after following the descent broadcast in his office, called the landing the greatest moment of our time. The heaviest fighting in several weeks has occurred in the Middle East this weekend. Both Israel and Egypt said their air forces had bombed military targets within the other's territory. Israel said its planes had knocked out ground-to-air missile sites and damaged artillery, mortar, and tank positions in the northern part of the Suez Canal. Egypt said it downed 17 Israeli jets. Ground fighting was reported as tapering off late Sunday. The president of Colombia, Carlos Lleras Restrepo, said in an address to the Colombian Congress that the United Nations is no longer capable of maintaining world peace and should be reshaped. That's the news from the Voice of America newsroom. This is Gene Peterson reporting.
And this is the Voice of America, our program originating from Washington and the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. We are reporting live and direct the activities of Apollo 11 and particularly the lunar module, which now rests on the surface of the moon. The two American astronauts scheduled now to leave the lunar module at 1 hour GMT. To begin their 2.5 hours of work upon the surface of the moon. We now have the following announcement for our listeners in the Soviet Union. The Voice of America will broadcast a special coverage of the activities of American astronauts on the surface of the moon in the Russian, Ukrainian, and Armenian languages beginning at 4 a.m. Moscow time. This broadcast can be heard on most of the same frequencies regularly used for Russian language broadcasts. Well, there can be no question that the moon is not a hospitable place to visit, and the men who go there must take along their earthly environmental equipment in order to survive. Morris Joyce reports on the well-dressed lunar visitor.
The lunar suit is more like a house than a garment. It protects its wearer against the heat and the cold, as well as from radiation and the impact of small meteoroids. It also contains what amounts to a small radio station, enabling the astronauts to talk with each other and with mission control on Earth. And perhaps most important of all, the lunar suit has its own interior atmosphere, providing the astronaut with the air he breathes. The men who wear this extremely complicated garment must be able to move around and perform some work on the surface of the moon. For this reason, the suit is flexible and made up of several layers. Closest to the astronaut's skin is a net-like garment made of tiny tubes carrying water to regulate body temperature. It is covered by an armor-like suit enclosing the entire body, except the head, hands, and feet of the astronaut. This custom-fitted suit, equipped with a gas bladder, makes up for the lack of atmospheric pressure on the moon. The outer covering of the lunar suit is a many-layered, fire-resistant garment designed to furnish protection against the meteoroids. The hands and feet of the lunar visitors are covered by special gloves and boots with a transparent pressure helmet protecting the head. The radio, the oxygen, and other supplies are contained in a large backpack. The suit, the backpack, and the other equipment, practically built around the astronaut's body, would be extremely heavy to carry on Earth. Fortunately, the moon has only 1/6 of the Earth's gravity, making everything that much lighter. Should the astronaut stumble and fall, he can get on his feet by performing a number of push-ups, which give him enough momentum to stand up. If he falls on his back, he must turn around first to lie on his stomach before he can get up. The self-contained lunar garment is equipped with separate containers to store the carbon dioxide and body waste products while the astronaut is out on the moon's surface. On his return to the lunar module, he will connect these containers to the spacecraft's waste disposal system for their removal. Thus, the well-dressed astronaut can spend up to 3 hours in the relative comfort of his lunar garment outside his spacecraft. This is Morris Joyce.
Somewhat earlier, we were talking in rather personal terms about our own reactions to the safe landing of the lunar module on the surface of the moon. We mentioned perspiring hands, fingernails which had bitten into the skins of the palms of hands. But for a little more extensive reporting on reaction in the United States to that landing, VOA's Ray Kabaker looks at that reaction.
Absolutely amazing. It was a dream, the greatest thing that's ever happened. Those are typical comments from Americans in the streets reacting to the moon landing. Like people in most of the world, they are now waiting for the sights and sounds of a man's first footsteps on the moon. Big screen television receivers have been installed at several places in New York City, including Kennedy International Airport. And a lively celebration is planned for Central Park this evening, with light shows, films, and the launch of a manned hot air balloon. Most Americans won't get much sleep. But then Monday, or Moon Day, as it's proclaimed in some store windows, will be a holiday for most people. One cartoonist, anticipating the national state of mind at this moment, pictured a man slumped before a television receiver, his clothes wrinkled, his jaw unshaven, his eyes bleary and bagged. A nearby ashtray is mounted high with tiny cigarette butts. That's the 31 consecutive hours of television coverage promised by all three national networks. But here, at Midway Point, that fascination is still tinged with anxiety. Summing up his feelings right after his son had landed on the moon, Mr. Stephen Armstrong said he'd ask everyone to keep praying to get them off that moon. This is Ray Kabaker in Washington.
And this is the Voice of America broadcasting, of course, the activities of the lunar module, which is now resting safely on the surface of the moon. We have with us in our studio Don Beatty, who is from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Don, I'd like to put a question to you about the attitude or the angle at which the lunar module is now resting on the surface of the moon. We had been told before the flight of Apollo 11 that when it comes time for the ascent to be made from the surface of the moon
preliminary to the rendezvousing of the lunar module and the command vehicle, that the lunar module could be standing on the surface of a moon at a 42-degree angle and still make that ascent. But according to the last report I heard, the lunar module is standing at only 4 degrees, which seems to be quite incredible. Do you attribute this primarily to the skill of Neil Armstrong, who piloted that vehicle down the last few meters and made the landing?
Well, I'm sure that was the primary reason that the LEM finally came to rest in such a almost horizontal position, and his skill was very evident, I think, in the whole operation. The landing site, of course, was specifically chosen so that there were no high slopes if he stayed out of the craters. And because of this, we had very high confidence that we wouldn't reach such high angles in a nominal touchdown.
But I understand that geologists already are extremely pleased, because one of the things which they would like to get back from the moon would be samples of the lunar soil, which comes from at least the lip of a crater. And apparently he was able to park that module very, very close to a crater, which would indicate that if all goes well while they're doing their extravehicular activity, that he or his companion, Buzz Aldrin, will be able to pick up some of those samples from the crater.
Well, it certainly sounds that way. He described that there were rock fields or strewn fields several crater diameters from the crater that he was maneuvering away from, so I think that we can expect that he will be able to collect material which probably came out of a rather large crater. And this, of course, is something that all of the Earth scientists who are associated with the sample return are very, very much interested in.
Well, now, is it more important to get samples of crater material than the material which is going to be on the more or less flat plane of the lunar surface?
Well, I think for this first landing, we'll be very happy to get almost any material back, since, of course, no one knows for sure what the lunar material will be. I think that we'd like to get back material from a crater, because this does give us an idea of what the lunar rock is like below the surface. However, we're just as much interested on this first landing in getting material from a rather flat, uninteresting part of the Mare.
Now, speaking about the site of the landing, of course, you have devoted a great deal of your time at NASA to a study of the landing terrain. I believe that there had been originally something perhaps in the neighborhood of 30 different possible sites where perhaps the American vehicle could land, and this was narrowed down then, wasn't it, to 8, and then subsequently reduced to 5. And where did they actually land out of the final 5?
Well, that's correct. We finally had 5 sites, and about a month or so ago, we eliminated the easternmost of these 5 sites, so we actually were only working with 4 sites. And the Apollo 11 has finally touched down in Site 2, which is the easternmost of the acceptable sites that we were looking for this mission.
Now, how does this site differ from some of the other areas?
Well, the eastern site has some special characteristics that the other sites don't have. The moon has been described as having red mare and blue mare as an example. These are very, very faint shadings which you normally couldn't see with your eye, and they also denote that possibly the eastern mare has a slightly different age than the western mare. We would, of course, like to land on the next mission in one of the western mare to see whether these original theories are correct.
I noticed that we do have another report from one of our two correspondents, VOA correspondents, standing by at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. Red Turner is going to be talking with the command module pilot, Michael Collins, and he's going to talk about, I believe, the development of the space suit and how important that is.
Mike, you have specialized for a time in work on pressure suits, suits used by astronauts. You had one of the most exciting periods of extravehicular activity on your Gemini 10 flight. What do you feel is good, bad, or otherwise, and what direction do you think that pressure suits are going? Are we going to get them any smaller in the future? Are they really safe?
Well, I've been out of the pressure suit business for several years. As a matter of fact, I was the suit subject for the suit competition, which picked a particular company which designed the suit that that Buzz and Neil will be using when they walk on the lunar surface. And I I feel now, as I did at the time, that the suit they'll be wearing is the best possible suit they could have. It will not always be that way. I think, as in any particular part of American technology, somebody is always trying to come up with a better idea, and thus it will be in the spacesuit business. And I think today there are probably improvements upon the theme, and as we go down the line, there will be small and perhaps some very large improvements made in the spacesuit business. It's a tough business. People who are working night and day, for example, to design a joint which can imitate the human shoulder. But if you try to write the equations of motion of a human shoulder joint and all the convolutions through which it moves, and then you try to translate that into bellows and pipes and wires and coils, you find you're very frustrated. It's a difficult thing to do.
And, but you feel comfortable inside yours now, right?
All pressure suits inherently are uncomfortable rascals, but I think, yes, in general, they've been made as comfortable as is possible.
Thanks, Mike.
We believe that we should add, perhaps, an obvious and parenthetical note that our VOA correspondent, Rhett Turner, did not, in fact, go into outer space to conduct that conversation with astronaut Michael Collins. That was recorded several days before the launching of Apollo 11. But when the two astronauts, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, have completed their work on the moon, and after they have rested for several hours, then they will ascend from the moon for a rendezvous with the command module. Now, this is a rendezvous in the void of space, and man cannot depend upon his eyes alone to bring the two speeding craft into a mating. He must depend primarily upon electronic equipment to guide him. This will be radar, a transmission device in effect, and a receiver. It's called the Rendezvous Radar, and it was built by one of America's electronics pioneering firms, RCA. I went to this firm to talk with Mr. Andy Warren, who is the manager of the Lunar Module Program at RCA. Now, this conversation, too, was recorded several months ago. And my first question to Mr. Warren was, what has been your most important contribution? And to this he replies.
Our primary contribution, I believe, is the Rendezvous Radar and Transponder. These are the equipments which will guide the astronauts in the ascent from the lunar surface and back to the command module, which has remained in orbit during the lunar exploration.
Can you explain how this radar is going to function?
The requirements here, which are, I guess, a little bit unique, are, first off, almost total hands-off operation of the equipment. There are no controls, no adjustments. The computer, which is on board the LEM, does the designation, that is, points the antenna in the direction that the command module is expected to appear. It enables the circuitry in the radar to begin tracking, and when the radar has acquired the transponder, it automatically goes into the track mode and feeds the proper information into the computer.
How accurate is the radar going to be in picking up the proper orbit?
The radar has the capability of measuring range to an accuracy of 1/4 of 1%. It also has the capability of measuring the range rate, which is another parameter which is vital to the trajectory, to an accuracy of about 0.5 foot per second. The angular accuracy is in the order of 2 milliradians, where a milliradian, as you, I'm sure, are aware, is about 1/17 of a degree.
The question of reliability or dependability always arises when we start thinking about this extremely sophisticated electronic equipment, and particularly as it might involve the lives of men in outer space.
This is quite true, and we have been very much preoccupied with the reliability situation. We have methods for calculating reliability of the various parts and many tests which are run to verify this, although it's obviously impossible to verify a predicted operation which is out in the 3/9s and 4/9s probability. We therefore have set up a failure analysis situation in which any failure of any type which occurs during the integration and test of a radar must be thoroughly and completely explained and corrected before that vehicle, that radar, is committed to launch. We also use high reliability parts, which are subjected to additional screening and burn-in tests to weed out whatever infant mortality is left. We are very careful in our thermal design in order to make sure that the parts are not anywhere nearly running at the maximum temperatures. We set an upper limit of 185 degrees Fahrenheit for case temperatures of parts, where most vendors will guarantee part operation up to something like 250. It's this kind of derating which gives us the reliability that we need. The lunar stay is a fairly interesting aspect of the thermal design which has been required. The antenna for the rendezvous radar, which is mounted on top of the LEM, must be stowed during the lunar stay in such a position that the electronics, which is mounted behind the antenna, is protected from the tremendous heat input from the lunar surface. The lunar surface, as you know, is at a temperature of about 250 degrees Fahrenheit. This temperature will damage the electronics if no particular steps are taken to avoid it. Strangely enough, the optimum position for stowing the antenna is actually pointing directly at the sun. The way this works out is that the back of the antenna, with the super insulation that we mentioned before, while pointing at the lunar surface, protects the electronics from the heat input from the moon, while the white face of the reflector, to which the electronics are thermally connected, pointing toward the sun, also sees around the periphery of the sun the very deep cold of outer space. The net result of the input from the sun and the cooling effect of outer space is actually a reduction in heat looking at the sun compared to what you would get in looking at the moon. If we were to allow the antenna to point at the lunar surface while the lunar exploration was in process, we would be out of business in something like half an hour or so due to the heat input. On the other hand, we can point indefinitely at the sun.
That was a conversation which I had recently with Mr. Bandy Warren, who is the RCA Lunar Module Program Manager. Mr. Warren described the functioning of the rendezvous radar equipment, which is aboard the lunar module, which is now resting on the surface of the moon. And it's been resting there now since 20 hours, 18 minutes, and 42 seconds GMT. A remarkable landing, a safe landing. The two American astronauts are safe, they are well. And beyond that, at 1 hour, Greenwich Mean Time, they are going to begin their extravehicular activity. Their schedule has been advanced by several hours, and at that time, man will step from the lunar module, slowly climb down the ladder, and will stand on the moon. The first time that a human being has ever stood, has ever placed his feet, has ever been a human presence on another planet. This is the Voice of America. We are broadcasting live and direct from our studios in Washington, D.C., as well as from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, where VOA correspondents are reporting activities as they occur there. There will be a news report in 2 minutes and 15 seconds. We do have an announcement for listeners in Southeast Asia and in Africa. Those living in Southeast Asia who are tuned to this VOA frequency at this time should change frequencies in 1 minute and 50 seconds. The frequency to which you may now be listening, if it is 11790 kilocycles, should be changed to 15210 or 17735. That's for listeners in Southeast Asia. We will repeat, if you are now tuned to 11790, please change to 15210 or 17735. Now, for listeners in Africa, if you are now tuned to 15445 kilocycles, you should change your radio setting to 7195 or 21670 kilocycles. We will repeat the message for listeners to the VOA in Africa. If you are now tuned to 15445, please change your radio setting to 7195 or 21670. And in case you may have tuned to the VOA in a matter of about the last 1.5 minutes, we will repeat what we have said a number of times, and we say it, of course, with verve. The American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin are on the surface of the moon. Their extravehicular activity, their work on the moon, will begin at 1 hour Greenwich Mean Time. And, of course, the Voice of America will be broadcasting live and direct as they step onto the moon. This program is originating in Washington.
A color photograph of the three Apollo 11 astronauts is available in limited supply for our VOA listeners. We will send you one if you write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible.
This is The Voice of America. We will return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
The world waited, and then it cheered. Man's first landing on the moon was followed via television and radio by an estimated 500 million persons around the world. Most were in their homes, but many were in such places as London's Trafalgar Square or New York's Rockefeller Center. At the moment of the fact of man on the moon, there were shouts of congratulations. In Trafalgar Square, a witness described the shouts as a massed scream of delight. One woman there expressed the feelings of most of the world when she exclaimed, "Thank God they have made it." Officials broke into applause at the Jodrell Bank Observatory in London, where they had been tracking the spacecraft's progress. The director of the observatory, Sir Bernard Lovell, called the touchdown one of the moments of greatest drama in the history of man. He continued that it opens the most enormous opportunities for future exploration of the universe. Sir Bernard, who is considered Britain's leading astronomer, concluded by saying that those of us who have watched the development of the space program will wish to convey our heartfelt congratulations to the Americans on this demonstration of their tremendous superiority. Before the lunar landing, President Nixon led the nation in a religious service for the success of the astronauts' mission. The president reminded his audience of more than 300 administration officials that this is an historic day, the day when man will first set foot on the moon. Also participating in the service was astronaut Frank Borman, who has been with the president throughout the mission. Colonel Borman read the same passage from the Bible which he read while he was in space last December as commander of Apollo 8. The president will talk to astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin when they leave their module to walk on the lunar surface. Britain's Jodrell Bank Observatory says the unmanned Soviet moon probe Luna 15 dropped into an orbit as low as 16 kilometers from the moon. Jodrell director Lovell said it passed over the moon's Sea of Tranquility at the same time that American astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin were approaching the landing area in Eagle. The Soviet Union has assured the United States that the unmanned craft will not impede the Apollo mission. And in Houston, U.S. astronaut Frank Borman received a cable from the Soviet Union Saturday detailing a change in the course of the Luna 15 orbit. There is speculation among British scientists that the Soviet craft might either land or carry out reconnaissance on the Apollo mission. General Earl Wheeler, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, left Saigon Sunday after a 4-day assessment of the situation in South Vietnam. He told reporters he saw no political meaning in the current scaled-down level of enemy attacks. General Wheeler said enemy infiltration, although comparatively less than last year, is continuing. And he noted that communist combat activity has always occurred in cycles. General Wheeler declined to discuss future U.S. troop withdrawals, but said the South Vietnamese armed forces were making progress in increasing their combat capability. In the war, government troops reported capturing 15 tons of ammunition at communist supply points near the western sector of the demilitarized zone. Enemy gunners shelled the Bien Hoa air base north of Saigon, causing light damage and casualties, and they sent two rockets into the capital. It was the fourth attack against Saigon this month. Sunday marked one of the heaviest days of fighting in the Middle East in recent weeks. Israel has reported that the ground fighting in the Suez Canal area tapered off late Sunday. There is no word yet from the Egyptian side. In the air, for the first time since the Six-Day War of June 1967, both Cairo and Tel Aviv said their air forces had bombed military targets inside each other's territory. Egypt said it downed 17 Israeli jets. Israel admitted losing two planes and said five Egyptian planes were downed. The fighting began early Sunday with an Israeli attack on the Egyptian fortified island of Qadra in the northern Gulf of Suez. At dusk, the Egyptian Air Force hit back with a raid into the Israeli-occupied Sinai Peninsula. An Israeli military spokesman said the purpose of the unprecedented use of air power in the northern part of the Suez Canal was to keep the situation from deteriorating. He said Israeli planes knocked out ground-to-air missile positions and dealt a heavy blow to Egyptian artillery, mortar, and tank positions. Senator Edward Kennedy is reported resting under a doctor's care at his family summer home in Hyannisport, Massachusetts. The senator was the driver of a car which went off a bridge and into a deep pond early Saturday. A young woman passenger in the automobile was drowned. Police officials say they will bring charges against Senator Kennedy Monday for leaving the scene of an accident. The senator, who said he was in shock after the mishap, reported it to police about 9 hours after it occurred. Yugoslavia and the United Arab Republic are reported to be in agreement that a ministerial meeting of non-aligned nations should be held later this year, about the time the United Nations General Assembly goes into its annual session in New York. This was revealed in an interview with the Yugoslav news agency by Yugoslavia's Deputy Foreign Minister Radivo Ulevic. He recently returned to Belgrade from talks in Cairo. The recent consultative meeting of non-aligned nations in the Yugoslav capital approved holding such a meeting but did not set any date. That's the news from the Voice of America newsroom. This is Jack Moyles reporting.
So man has been on the moon now for 3 hours and almost 51 minutes. Two American astronauts today landed on the moon. They brought their lunar module safely down to the lunar surface the first time that a human being has ever stepped onto another celestial body. Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin landed on the lunar surface at 20 hours, 18 minutes Greenwich Mean Time on Sunday. The Voice of America is reporting from Washington and the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, live and direct all of the activities of the flight of Apollo 11. At 1 hour Greenwich Mean Time, 1 hour Greenwich Mean Time, the two American astronauts will descend from the lunar module to be the first people to stand on the moon. Now, the Voice of America brings you the conversation between Eagle, the lunar module, and Mission Control in Houston from the time the landing craft was just 1.5 kilometers above the lunar surface.
Altitude 4200. Houston, you're a go for landing. Over. Roger, understand. Go for landing. 3,000 feet. Sound alarm. 1201.
1201.
Roger, 1201 alarm. We're go. Same type. We're go.
2,000 feet. 2,000 feet. Into the ag. 47 degrees.
Roger.
47 degrees.
Eagle looking great. Your go.
Altitude 1,600. 1,400 feet. Still looking very good.
Roger, 1202. We copy it.
35 degrees. 35 degrees. 750. Coming down to 23. 700 feet. 21 down. 33 degrees. 100 feet down at 19. 540 feet down at 30. Down at 15. 400 feet down at 9. Escape forward. 1050 feet down at 4. 30 and a half down. They're pegged on horizontal velocity. 300 feet down 3.5. 47 forward. Hold up. On 1.5 down. 70. 80. Got the shadow out there. 50 down at 2.5. 19 forward. Altitude, velocity, light, 3.5 down, 220 feet, 13 forward, 11 forward, coming down nicely, 200 feet, 4.5 down, 5.5 down, 160 feet, 6.5 down, 5.5 down, 9 forward, good, 120 feet. 100 feet, 3.5 down, 9 forward, 5%. 185. 75 feet, guys looking good, down a half. 6 forward.
60 seconds.
Lights on. 6. Down 2.5. Forward. Forward. 30 feet down, 2.5. Picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down. Straight shadow. 4 forward. 4 forward, drifting to the right a little. 20, down a half.
30 seconds.
Forward, just. Okay. 30. Contact light. Okay, engine stop. ACA at a descent. Hose control, both auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
And there was a great sigh of relief. The Eagle has landed. The words from Command Pilot Neil Armstrong that the Eagle has landed. The lunar module had set down onto the surface of the moon. That was a landing which took place 3 hours and 55 minutes ago. And now, at 1 hour Greenwich Mean Time, Neil Armstrong will open the hatch of the lunar module and will slowly descend the ladder which will put him, a human being, onto the surface of the moon. You're listening to the Voice of America. We are broadcasting live and direct from our studios in Washington, as well as from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, with reports of the flight of Apollo 11 and the lunar module. When the commander of Apollo 11 steps out of the LEM to commence extravehicular activities on the lunar surface, the first thing which he will do is to deploy the MESA, and that's short for Modular Equipment Stowage Assembly. A few days ago, Norman Guerin discussed the MESA and its function with Glenn Miller, who is the chief of the Lunar Systems Office of the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
When Neil Armstrong steps from the LEM to make his descent to the lunar surface, he will pull a D-ring and deploy what is called the MESA. Glenn Miller, what is the MESA? Where is it located?
The MESA is located in the Quad 4 of the LEM descent stage, and which is 180 degrees from the ESAP experiments. The MESA, by the way, is the Modularized Equipment Stowage Assembly. As the name implies, it's a pallet to stow the various equipment. There's several experiments, the solar wind experiment, the Gnomon, and the close-up camera. The solar wind experiment, primarily to collect some composition of the solar wind that will be deployed on the lunar surface and brought back. The Gnomon is a local vertical reference instrument to be photographed with some of the cameras that the crew will have on the surface. And the close-up camera is to take a stereo close-up picture of the lunar surface in its essentially undisturbed state at 1/6 G on the lunar surface. This information will complement the information gained from the soil that's brought back to the Earth. The soil that's brought back will be contained in the rock boxes, as we call them. There's two of them. The lunar surface samples, which will be brought back, will be contained in the sample return containers, two of which are installed on the MESA.
Mr. Miller, I think our listeners perhaps would be interested to know exactly what happens when Neil Armstrong pulls the D-ring and the lanyard. Could you explain that?
When the D-ring's pulled, this releases the latching mechanism for the MESA. And the MESA is deployed, or essentially falls out of the side of the descent stage, although it's hinged on the bottom. It pivots out to an angle which is nominally set for about 150 degrees and should, if the LEM lands perfectly level, be at a height for the crew to operate and remove the equipment from the MESA.
It also serves as a work table, I understand, when they're conducting their lunar experiments.
Yes, it does. There is a table mounted on the MESA which folds out, is designed specifically to contain the sample return containers. When the sample return containers are taken out of the MESA, they are set on the table, and the crew will collect samples in the immediate area and bring them back and put them in the container. After filling the container is taken into the ascent stage by an equipment transfer cable.
In the very first stages, then, the EVA will sort of center around the MESA by necessity.
Yes, it will. The first part of the EVA will generally be familiarization of the crew with the 1/6 G environment and a limited inspection of the external parts of the LEM. After this, the crew collects contingency samples, which are transferred to the ascent stage, all of this taking around 40 minutes. And then we go to the MESA, and the next hour or so will be spent deploying and using the tools on the MESA.
Thank you very much. Glenn Miller, Chief Lunar Systems Office, Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston. This is Norman Guerin.
We're back here in our Voice of America studios in Washington. The two American astronauts have now been on the surface of the moon for almost 4 hours and 2 minutes. They will begin their extravehicular activity at 1 hour Greenwich Mean Time. As we indicated to many VOA listeners somewhat earlier, we are going to attempt throughout the progress of the reporting by the VOA to talk to some of the officials of different firms, corporations, which have contributed to the success up to this point of the flight of Apollo 11. The prime contractor for the building of the Apollo 11 space vehicle is North American Rockwell. At the time that North American began the construction of the Apollo space vehicle, it was called North American Aviation. We have a spokesman from that firm on a telephone circuit who is in California. He is Earl Blount, and he is the Public Relations Vice President for the Space Division of North American. Earl, congratulations.
Well, thanks very much. We're certainly looking forward to completing this very exciting mission here in a few more days. As you know, our spacecraft is kind of the one that's staying in orbit around the moon and wishing he were down there with these other two fellas. But it's certainly been a wonderful mission so far, and we're looking forward to a successful conclusion here soon.
Earl, you've been involved in the construction of these space vehicles now for a period extending up to about 8 years. How does it feel? What is the emotional reaction of people at North American now that that great Apollo 11 lifted off the other day from Cape Kennedy, made that flight to the moon, and of course now with the safe descent of the lunar module?
Well, thanks to television, we were able to show all of our some 18,000 employees the actual real-time liftoff from the Cape. And while I was down there in Florida myself, I understand that there wasn't a dry eye in the place here in Downey. Work stopped and people couldn't help but have moisture in their eyes. And I know all of us had a kind of a big spot in our throats here at this time.
Earl, at any time during the the pre-liftoff phase and any time during the flight itself, was there any apprehension, any doubt that there was going to be success?
No, I don't think there is any doubt, but, you know, a lot of us are worrywarts, and every time there's the slightest indication of a malfunction, why, of course, we immediately start worrying about it. But of the several manned launches to date, this one has been unique in not having a single development of that nature that caused any concern. We've had our fingers crossed, and they'll remain crossed, of course, till we get these fellows back. But this has been remarkable in that every system has just seemed to operate just like we all wished it would all the time.
Well, Earl, in the building of this vehicle, because of the fact that it was scheduled to make the moon flight, do you think that there was any particular extra work which went into its construction?
Well, I'd have to say yes, indeed. The particular man in charge of this vehicle, Al Kellett, very early put a sign on this one that said 107, and he thought it was going to be the lucky one chosen for the big mission. And he instilled in his people, I think, a feeling of extreme pride that, by golly, they better do everything right because this one's got a long way to go. And I think it certainly paid off in the way that the spacecraft has performed to date.
Perhaps you could explain for the benefit of our listeners, you've already told us, of course, that the command vehicle, the North American command vehicle, is now in orbit around the moon. But perhaps you could explain for us briefly, Earl, what the role of the command vehicle will be in the next few days, and what types of functions will it have to perform?
Well, yes, actually, until they lift off the lunar surface, the pilot left in the command module, Mike Collins, has really little to do except sit up there and wait for the LEM to take off from the moon. Unfortunately, there's just nothing we can do to effect a rescue at this point. However, once that LEM lifts off of the lunar surface and reaches any altitude above 35,000 feet, we can effect a rescue, even though the LEM, for some reason or other, could not come back up to the approximately 50-mile altitude where the command module waits for him.
Well, in other words, then, you have some flexibility as to the trajectory of the command vehicle.
Yes, we can go into any orbit that would clear the terrain of the lunar surface, as long as that is a fixed orbit, which, in other words, means we can come as low as roughly 35,000 feet. But we feel sure that LEM's going to continue working as it has, and that the rest of this mission is going to go just as well. But you might be interested in knowing that during those critical moments of touchdown, Mike in his command module was doing what's called a mirror maneuver. In other words, he was ready to do just the reverse of what the LEM or the lunar module was doing, so that should a problem develop, he could have come down and effected a rescue. So there was a safeguard there, and we're pleased that, of course, it wasn't necessary.
Well, you've spent a good part of your professional life now in the field of technology and science are certainly related to it. Do you know of anything which would ever compare to the flight of Apollo 11?
Guys, no, we have Mr. Lindbergh's son, John, in the plant today doing a television interview, and he, of course, is a very famous underwater explorer, and they asked him how he felt this compared with his dad's great voyage across the ocean some years ago, and he had to admit that even from his standpoint of paternal...
I see that we apparently have lost our telephone connection to California, and therefore we have lost the voice of Mr. Burl Blount, with whom we were speaking. However, I think that Mr. Blount has covered the salient points relative to the command module of Apollo 11 space vehicle. And now, we notice that President Nixon watched and listened today as astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin landed on the moon. A report now from VOA correspondent Robert Sturtevant at the White House.
President Nixon sat alone in his executive office building working quarters next to the White House to watch the televised report of the landing of American astronauts on the moon. Afterward, he sent word to newsmen that it was the greatest moment of our time and represents another step in the whole history of man. The president, who had been working on details of his forthcoming trip to Asian capitals and to Bucharest, looked at the broadcast on a color television set for an hour up to the moment of touchdown. Then, after the landing, he called Secretary of State William Rogers to discuss the success, indicating that he anticipated what he called immensely favorable reaction around the world. He told Mr. Rogers, a White House spokesman said, that the event would bring the people of the world closer together. A few moments after talking with the State Secretary, the President took a call from Dr. Thomas Paine, director of the Space Agency, who reported officially the landing of the two Apollo astronauts. Dr. Paine expressed confidence that the mission of bringing the men back to Earth safely would be successful. The President told the Space Director he was certain that the same technological genius that got the men to the moon would return them safely. Colonel Frank Borman, an earlier astronaut who visited the region of the moon last December, watched the landing from a White House office and talked with the president some minutes later. The president told Colonel Borman that the achievement points the way to new breakthroughs in progress, not only in space, but to better solutions of problems at home. Robert Sturtevant, Voice of America, the White House.
Shortly after the lunar module came to rest on the moon's surface, Prime Minister Harold Wilson of Great Britain gave his reaction to the successful landing. While we are waiting for the voice of Prime Minister Harold Wilson, we would like to remind you that you are listening to The Voice of America in Washington. At 1 hour Greenwich Mean Time, the two American astronauts are scheduled to leave the lunar module and descend to the surface of the moon to become the first human beings ever to stand on another celestial body. The American astronauts have been on the moon now for 4 hours and 10 minutes. Now, Prime Minister Harold Wilson of Great Britain.
I think the first feeling of everyone in Britain who has seen and heard the news of this incredible achievement will be one of heartfelt relief that this very dangerous part of the mission has been safely accomplished. We all know there's still more to be seen through. And I think the second feeling will be one of tremendous admiration. Admiration first for the way in which this great and historic achievement was conceived and planned. I suppose it's an achievement which incorporates all the work, all the discoveries of the mathematicians and the scientists and the space experts almost from the earliest days of mathematics and science, and incorporates the technologies and the experience of many nations. But pride of place obviously goes to those in the United States who have developed the missiles, who have developed the technology, who have developed the modules, who have developed the computerization, under the overall conception and planning of the United States Space Agency. But equally there's admiration for the courage and fortitude, not only of these three gallant astronauts, but all those others who have gone before and who have made this possible. admiration, too, for the bravery and the fortitude of their families who have been unable to do more than stand by and watch and who must be feeling a tremendous sense of pride at this moment. And now, I think, our greatest feeling of all is our prayers for the safe return of these three very grave men.
Prime Minister Harold Wilson of Great Britain. This program is originating in Washington.